This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm very pleased to be here this evening to discuss our research at the Allosphere Research Facility, which is in Ealing's Hall in the California Nanosystems Institute. And I'd like to begin our discussion this evening by asking you a few questions. What would it be like if you could generate, control, and transform very complex information like quantum mechanics and fluid dynamics, the way a composer or an artist makes a work of art? What if you could use all of your senses to perceive this information intuitively and as second nature? And what if we could make the computer a natural extension of ourselves? Could we actually make a creative computational language that would allow us to be able to represent this complex information in many different scientific fields the way that artists and composers make works of art? Well, there's a team of us researchers at the Allosphere Research Facility. We're media artists, media scientists, and media engineers. And we found a way to collaborate with our domain research partners in other fields in order to map very complex information visually and sonically in time and space. We're making an interactive visual, aural, immersive data discovery system that's going to allow us to use the computer as an experimental platform, as an instrument that we can interactively perform and control very complex information and ask the same kind of questions that experimentalists do when they're in their laboratories and they're able to do investigations when they don't know what they're looking for. Very difficult in the field of computation. Very difficult on computational systems that rely on one knowing what one is looking for, a precise instrument to be able to do statistical analysis and machine learning. But how can we use it as an instrument to experiment and to explore? This is very important to me, something that I've been dealing with for the past 31 years of my life. I was an experimentalist many years ago. Long ago in a valley far away, I was an orchestral composer. I was working with instruments. I was an instrumentalist, just like my experimentalist in the Nanosystems Institute, working with atomic force microscopes, working with TEM microscopes, not knowing exactly what they're looking for, but looking for discovery, and having the same problems now that I had 30 years ago when I met the computational platform. And that was the disconnect of iteration, of flow, and being able to use my intuitive processes when I'm using the computer. This is very frustrating. The cycle's broken. We seemed to be able to solve it in my world 30 years later, when we can interactively perform and compose digital information using the computer as an instrument. We still haven't tackled the aspects of what it means when you have real performers on stage performing a piece. And what is the human-computer interaction control all about? This is a really important aspect of this platform. So as we go forward and we try to make for our scientists these tools to allow them to experiment and discover, we're mapping very large-scale data sets, applying the same techniques that I applied for the past 30 years as a composer and an artist on how to make these complex systems. Why composers and artists? Why should composers and artists talk to scientists and other researchers? What do we have to offer? Well, that's an interesting question. I hope maybe I'll answer some of those questions for you. We're not commercial artists, okay? We're not out aimed to please the general public and make information for you to consume as product. We're research artists. We made decisions decisions that made us even lose our audience after a while. Because what do artists do? We work with very complex mathematical equations, visually and sonically, that we unfold in time and space. How comes when you go into MoMA sometimes and you see some weird abstract piece of art and you look at it and say, what is that? Well, at least you're having a dialogue, right? At least you're looking at this piece and trying to understand what you maybe don't know. Some very complex mathematics that might be in front of you, that's lines and shapes. That's what we do. We know how to represent information, very complex mathematics, in ways that most people don't even realize. So if we work with our domain scientists to represent their information, maybe together we can try to tackle what's happening right now, because information is becoming so large, so complex, so hard to hold on to. How can we make a language that will allow us to be able to inform ourselves about this information? It's very interesting. We're pattern matching beasts. That's what we do very well. We can find patterns in information. Why can you remember melodies of your favorite song, right? I mean, you can remember things. You have an intuitive control of a language. What if I could make a visual and aural language out of the Schrodinger equation? Quantum mechanics. So that you could go, aha, oh, I remember that sound. Long-term memory. This is going to aid to new scientific discoveries. We definitely know as artists, it's leading to new, compelling forms of art. And for us, there's no difference between the two. And this is the one thing that I am out there to tell everyone in society. The arts are not out there to entertain. We do complex mathematics, and we're losing a big portion of what we need to be teaching in the schools right now. So you can go forward and understand what's happening with object-oriented programming. We're going back to the memory palace. We have to remember voluminous amounts of information as we're computing it and generating it. I've got to stay on track because I have a 12-minute video I want to play to show you the work that we're doing. So making this computational platform is very important. Having this dialogue is important. Artists, composers, and visual artists know how to represent the data. I said we were media artists, media scientists, and media engineers working with domain researchers in other fields. What does that mean? Well, that means that my colleagues that are in my department, my graduate program in media arts and technology, are computer scientists, are electrical engineering colleagues. They're musicians, they're visual artists, but we all represent a very hybrid group of people. We're representational people. Even my computer science colleagues and my electrical engineering colleagues, we're working with user interface aspects of how the human and the computer will interact with one another. So we now work with our domain scientists that understand what's important in their data. Remember the one thing about us, we're agnostic to the data. We don't care if it's geodata, we don't care if it's economic data, we don't care if it's quantum mechanics, we don't care. You know, we will represent it. What does that mean? We better have the domain scientist next to us so we represent it right and we do not represent it wrong. Remember that the new Da Vincis, the new hybrids, are teams of specialists right now. It's going to take a long time to go deep. So I talked about this computational language that we're building, this visual, aural, interactive, mathematical language, but I haven't talked about the instrument that I designed in order to display this visual, aural, interactive language. This instrument, as you heard, is called the Allosphere. It's a three-story sphere in an echo-free chamber. Why did I build it so big? Oh, I get asked that a lot. I'll tell you why. Because nobody at all disputes the fact that we need large server farms in order to do high-performance computing. Nobody disputes the fact that a computer can be as big as a warehouse. But how are we looking at that data that we're computing in those warehouses of machines? on little tiny monitors, on little tiny screens. And what's happening is we're doing more data analytics and more machine learning. It's generating more and more pages of numbers. And my simulations colleagues are coming to me saying, we can't find patterns in our information. We cannot handle the voluminous amounts of information that are coming to us. So I built an instrument that's really a display. Think of the Allosphere as a large terminal interface hooked up to a big supercompute cluster, hopefully eventually, that will allow us to represent this data. Make it to human scale. How are my guys going to work at the subatomic level? You know, you got to get real big to get real small. So that's the idea of the canvas that we built. Why did we build something that big and something that's going to be multi-user when everything seems to be scaling down the mobile devices and everybody wants to put the Oculus Rift on their head and everybody wants the HoloLens and all of this stuff and everything? Because we're looking 10 to 15 years in the future, and I'm going to tell you what we're going to want. In the virtual research communities, we're going to want user group participation on research, on education, and on arts practice. That's the next level, the interactive narrative of the future, the theater of the future. And every story that we make, every narrative that you're going to see in the data that we make is a story that we're telling, because that's what the big data dilemma needs. You need to know what the narrative is, what is it that you're trying to find in your information, and you need to make sure you have ground truth principles to make sure that information is right. So we made it big so we can scale down to mobile devices. If I have everything in one place, then I can parse that data out anywhere, and I want you to start thinking of the following thing. Every time you look at your little cell phone, every time you go by a display, it's one window into a huge interconnected cyber virtual world that's out there. Okay? What's going to happen when you can have your data follow you? You got your iPhone here, you got data on there, all of a sudden you go by a plasma screen, your data's there and it's bigger. You go by another thing, your data's there and it's bigger, and your data's just following you out the door. It's getting to the point where it's very hard to see the difference between the virtual and the real. All right? So, at any rate, I think it's best for me. What time is it? I have 19 minutes left, so I have a 12-minute video I want to use. I think maybe it's best for me to play the video and talk to you about the work that we're going to do. And, then I'll have a little bit more time, and then we'll have time to discuss, and I can try to answer your questions, or maybe you can answer some of my questions. So before I start the video, what I want to do is I want to explain how I'm going to go through this video to you. I'm playing a 12-minute video. I'll be talking through most of the video. What we're going to do is we're going to actually do a virtual fly-through into the Allosphere. You're going to see us working on the bridge of the Allosphere. And I'm going to take you through, I think, about 6 research projects. We're going to start with flying into the cortex of my colleague's brain, fMRI data. We're going to go into an artificial simulation of a bioecosystem, which is nature as it could be, not nature as it is. That's my bioeco artists. And then we're going to go into a simulation of a chemical bond. It's actually work that was going on in solid-state lighting and energy with computational scientist Professor Christopher Vandeval. We did a visualization of some simulations that they've done on the possible discovery of a new chemical bond. And then we're going to go into cold, hard math and time-dependent Schrodinger equation. This is my newest work, not only mine. Mine equally with my former graduate student, now Professor Lance Putnam, and KITP physicist Professor Luca Politi, where together we've made an interactive visual and aural instrument out of the Schrodinger equation, splitting the electron of a hydrogen-like atom into superposition and watching it go into different orbital states and looking at that narrative. And then we're going to actually even do some economic data, so that I can show you that I can use the same computational platform and I can make worlds out of the data. Every set of data that you're going to see is going to have features that are going to define it as a world. And within that data, there's going to be changes of information that we're going to be using these little agents, computer programs, to do agent-based data mining. That's how we work together. That's how we compose and perform a work. You'll see people on the bridge of the Allosphere. They're not just standing there watching movies, okay? I had to make a video of this, but this is a whole real-time interactive computational platform. So when you see them standing there with things like jury-rigged Wiimotes with LEDs on the end of them and Nintendo joysticks and other controls that we make on our own, they're actually manipulating the data that's in front of them, well, immersed around them in the Allosphere instrument. So I'll talk through that. I'll go through those research projects, and then I'm going to end with, that I'm not going to talk, through the last 5 minutes of the video, with two and a half minute excerpts of just some cold, hard art. It is visualized mathematics, visualized audio, a piece by my former student, now Professor Lance Putnam, called S-Phase, which are visualized audio waveforms, and then we'll end with an excerpt of Rapture, which is a four-dimensional iterative mathematical equation that's visualized and sonified, and I'm not going to tell you any more than that. So I'm going to start the video. What we're going to do is as I said, this, we're going to go to the building. We're going to go to Ealing's Hall. Here we are, all of you know and love our campus. So there is the California Nanosystems Institute behind me, and these are all experimental laboratories, but at the end of the California Nanosystems Institute, my laboratory, one of the biggest information technology systems in the world. Why? New materials for information technology systems. I have a jealous reason for being with my material scientist in this building. This is the bridge of the Allosphere. We're going to go out the door, and you're going to go up top and see that it's really a sphere. And then we're going to go back down inside, and we're going to see researchers standing on the bridge of the Allosphere, going inside of the Schrodinger equation, watching electron flow, going inside the material lattice of atoms, the new chemical bond that I was talking about, or going inside my colleagues, the cortex of my colleague's brain, who was watching videos and registering his blood density levels at certain cues in the video so that we could see what perhaps was causing the brain activity in his mind. So you're seeing these as textures, these landscapes. That's really frozen blood from the fMRI machine. Here we are on the bridge of the Allosphere. I don't think you could guess which one is the scientist, the artist, or the engineer, because they really look different. But they are doing data mining, and I believe they're in the multi-center hydrogen bond. We can kind of see what they're looking at as we go over the bridge. Yes, that's what they are viewing at this particular point of time. And as I said, we work together as a team, putting these research projects together, artists, scientists, and engineers. Here's the first research project I want to talk about, AlloBrain, okay? Like I said, I'm using my computational language. I'm C++ code. I'm making features and fields out of the cold, hard data. What we get is we get functional MRI data, slices of 2D rasterized grids of spatial location of where the blood density levels are. We map those terrains in the system. We do things which are called isosurfaces. So you can see this is really a mesh of the brain. It's a software. We could do any kind of simulation in there and see how the flesh may contort, or else we can make new worlds out of this. These agents, these little rectangles, are computer doctors. They're reporting the blood density levels to you sonically. Higher pitches, higher densities, lower pitches, lower densities. And the white agents are less intelligent chaotic clustering agent than NERSC. Now we go on to yet another simulation, again, based on the same software. This is a simulated bioecosystem. It's nature as it could be, not nature as it is. Our features are we're in a fluid dynamics Navier-Stokes equation. In here we have biogenetic algorithms that are organizing, growing, procreating, and dying according to survival of the fittest algorithms based on appearance only. They communicate to one another. They actually, every object in there is a computer program. The same types of information that we saw in the brain data, which was real data, that's simulation. This now is simulation. Actually, it's three supercomputer simulations, about 6 months worth of simulations based on the multi-center hydrogen bond experiment that they did in the solid-state lighting and energy. And what you've got here is we got all the spatial locations of the atoms. I asked them what they wanted the atoms to look like. They said little rainbows of different colors. I think they look more like their emission spectrums. They didn't want to see those, their light frequencies, so we dropped them 27 octaves and you're hearing them. Those are known constants in the periodic table. So oxygen always has one sound, hydrogen always has one sound, zinc always has one sound. You can localize through the navigate through this lattice. Those streamlines are showing you the electrostatic charge density of the non-time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Now we're going into the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. This is all cold, hard math, not based on any real experiments, well, experiments from years ago, not based on any simulation data. This is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, which has been solved for the first element of the periodic table, hydrogen, which has one electron. But what my KITP physicist told me, which I thought was very interesting, is the electron can split and be in superposition and be in different orbitals at the same time. So what we're doing here is showing them different orbital combinations by solving for the first order derivatives of the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, making a visual a cloud of the electron in a quantum state, and then perturbing that state with these agents which are solving for the probability currents and gradients of the equation. It's like throwing a bunch of straws in the ocean and watching where they're going to go in order to chase where the electron is. Now, because of the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty, we can't tell exactly where the electron is, but we can get kind of close. That's what the probability wave function is all about. We went a step further. We added spin. I made a visual and aural synthesizer out of it, and you can see I'm actually clicking on the quantum numbers and changing these orbitals in real time. This will be the first piece that I actually create and perform along with Lance and Luca. It won't be my piece alone in order to do this research that we're doing here. And look at the beauty of the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and look at the fact that we had done two different representations that were totally different from one another in how we look at this. Now we're going to go to financial data. We're going to go to the money-changing machine. The money-changing machine graphs the relative value of three currencies for the years 2005 to 2010. The dollar at the top, the euro at the bottom, and the yen to the right on a projection from a hyperbolic plane. A gold future index is normalized to the geometric mean of the three currencies and is represented in the vertical axis as altitude above the currency plane. Four dimensions of financial information are graphed. Here in the summer of 2008, the euro reaches its peak value against the dollar. The global financial crisis is spreading. As soon as we see this, now we're seeing the unwinding of the yen carry trade as we have a chaotic dash across the graph as gold dips slightly and then raises in its price. And although these three dimensions of currency plane are not orthogonal, projection enables rotation to an arbitrary basis for analysis. In addition to the quantitative methods, a complex synthesis technique enables oral perception of the data at any time scale, from years down to a few seconds. If you listen closely to the sound, you can hear the churning noise of the daily trading cycle interspersed with sonic information that we call sound grains. We can move into different times and different spaces with this data by getting very, very close, slowing the data down, and being able to map. Remember, frequency only says how much and how quickly something is moving. How high the pitch is how quickly and how much is the amplitude. Now I'm going to let you enjoy 5 minutes, 2.5 minutes of S phase, visualized audio, and 2.5 minutes of rapture. S phase is exploring symmetry and asymmetry through visualizing complex harmonic waveforms. You're seeing what you're hearing here, completely connected with one another. Thank you. Definitely Tron-like. From my Slovakian grandmother, watching her crocheting, fine, careful attention to detail on every level. So this ends my lecture, and thank you.
When one is watching TV, I know this is a delay in what we see and what we hear, because the speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. Right now, in the projections that you were showing us, is there a very minimal delay in what we hear and what we see?
Well, what we hear and what we see, I mean, the speed of light is going to give you the spatial, the visual, right? You see that. What you hear, sound always travels in time. So there won't, it's not really a delay, it's just the way that we hear. What's so interesting is that we always have to worry about a time delay in anything that we hear. Because when we talk, you know, the sound comes to you directly, but it also bounces off of different structures, and the echoes come back, and the way the echoes accumulate will tell you physically what space you're in. So, I mean, and so this is what's so interesting about using all of our senses. You know, the cavemen knew that the saber tooth was sneaking up on them because of how they were able to perceive the sound. So we have 360-degree control of hearing, but with some delay that's going to happen as these echoes push, you know, come to us. We only have, what's so interesting is, and this is when we decide how we're going to map information among the senses. What I do is I sit down with my scientist and I say, okay, what of your data unfolds in time and what of your data unfolds in space? We have more resolution spatially, visually. We have more resolution temporally, sonically. So if you think about it, we see instantaneously when we look in front of us, it's about a 95-degree angle. To see in time, we have to turn our head. Okay? Again, we hear 360 degrees with a slight delay, but we do have 360-degree acumen with more up front than behind because of the way our ears are shaped. So see, these are all the things that we know very well as artists and how we perceive information through our senses. And one of the interesting things, I know I'm going off on, I'm sorry, I should wait and do more questions, but this will get me off onto the tangent of what I'm really making, that I don't say too loudly. I'm making a whole frequency continuum because there was a famous composer in the early 50s, his name was Karlheinz Stockhausen. And what Stockhausen realized when he was able to use a piece of electronic equipment and a pulse generator was that there's a frequency continuum in sound. And what you hear on the piano from the lowest note to the highest note is what you hear as pitch. But we can actually hear way far above the highest note on the piano. But that's what we call timbre. We cannot hear those as pitches. They're very, very high waveforms. And if we don't have a pitch that's vibrating what we call those harmonics, we make it up in our ear. That's what we call psychoacoustics. So he also realized that if you took the 7 octaves of the keyboard down 7 octaves and you mapped frequency, which is hertz, into time, you had direct relationships between time and frequency and timbre. So now I just want to take this up a notch, okay? Think about this. Whenever we heat an element up, the atoms vibrate, and they make sound waves called phonons. But they're very, very high up in the super audio and the super visual domain. What if I could do a mathematical transformation that we call a Fourier transform and actually pull them down into our visual and audio acumen? Can we start to hear and work with things that we can't? I'm very interested in the haptic sense, and we just hired a material computing professor. I believe haptics is a very interesting frequency vibration because we feel, mechanically, we feel vibrations from earthquakes that are below what you can hear up to 100 cycles per second, which is the octave below middle C on a keyboard. Yet and again, we feel heat as a chemical substance. And what's so interesting is we can visualize heat through infrared, which is a frequency we can't see. Come on. Okay? Does this mean that I could make a multimodal, multisensory language that would give you fly eyes and bat ears? Maybe I can. Maybe I can do that. And those are the things that excite artists very much. What is it that we can do? And I always tell my students, if you want to make something that doesn't exist, you better have the ground truth principles of what exists before you go and make something that's just pure fantasy. That way you can make the map.
This is going to sound kind of like Star Trek-y, but like, could you use this like to look into, like on those big telescopes to go into deep space and like map what you're doing and like see, like record it as the telescopes go through?
As a matter of fact, yes, we can. And we haven't done yet a visual mapping, but what was so interesting is we worked with the scientists that were part of the Planck satellite project. And what they're doing is they're mapping the cosmic microwave radiation background from the Big Bang. And they were very interested in us sonifying the CMB. So we made a spectral instrument to sonify the power spectrum of the CMB. And my one science colleague said, it's just going to sound like noise, you know, because it's a power spectrum. I said, but what if we were able to dial in other partials? And he said, why would you want to do that? You know, because, you know, we're here at the Earth. And I said, but what if we wanted to hear it like we were on Alpha Centauri? And he's like, well, why would anybody want to do that? I go, never mind. I mean, there may be entities in other parts of the universe. Wouldn't it be neat? So we start dialing this thing in. And you wouldn't believe it. It went from, you know, this noise to these beautiful, like, choral sounds of echoing voices. It was kind of frightening. But anyway, yes, absolutely. This is a very exciting thing. I would love to work with the redshift telescopes. And as a matter of fact, my students are. I have two of my students that are, I don't know why I didn't even think about this. They're actually visiting guest artists with the SETI project. And so they're mapping, and we'll probably have some of that information soon. So,
how did you come up with the instrument, and how did you know how to design it?
Oh, it's called the School of Hard Knocks. 31 years of research. I mean, I'm an on-the-job kid, and this is when you're going to understand that whatever you set out to do, you never know where you're going to go when you get there. I thought I was going to be an orchestral composer. I was trained in a conservatoire. I had dilemmas happening to me where I knew acoustics and psychoacoustics, and I wanted to grow my Stradivarius to the size of a concert hall and have people sit inside formats. And in the 80s, I couldn't get that ding-dang Stradivarius to grow. But I knew that if I had a violinist playing on stage and I had a big computer processing the sounds and I had surrounded the audience with speakers, I could make it happen. And that led me on a trip. And that led me to the computer. And it was the most disgusting trip I ever went on because, believe me, once I got to that platform, the flow completely stopped. You know, I mean, here, you know, you have hundreds of years of creating. You've got instruments. You know what they're going to sound like. You're writing, and you're just in the flow. And all of a sudden, now you've got this computer that's doing the following thing, though. And then I became like the ape around the monolith, right? We had a big PDP-11 computer dropped in our laps at the Eastman School of Music in 1981, before the internet. And we were like apes, you know, looking at this thing. Dun, dun! Because we knew that if we could get information into the computer, we could turn it into zeros and ones, and we could turn any information into zeros and ones, and then we could transform that information into anything. So that was so exciting and led me on this crazy trek. I lied through my teeth. I came to University of California, Santa Barbara with a year on a PDP-11 computer and said, yeah, I can build a big digital signal processing lab for computer music. And in 84, they threw me in the College of Engineering. And that is when wonderful things happened. In 84, a composer in the College of Engineering putting a digital to analog converter, which is the thing that turns numbers into sound. It's on all your CD players, right? I had my computer science colleague say, what the heck is that thing you're hanging on that computer? I said, it's a digital analog converter. It turns numbers into sound. They're like, why would anybody want a computer to make sound? You know, computers are processing numbers. And I said, I envision a day that people are going to not only want to make sound, they're going to want to see things with the computer. And they're like, are you crazy? Are you insane? I go, yes, but I'm functional. Okay? And I envision a day that you're going to have musicians on the East Coast and musicians on the West Coast, and they're going to want to jam with each other in real time. This was before the internet. Okay? And people are like, okay, why is this composer in the College of Engineering? But then I started hitting them with the bandwidth problems we were having, what we were coming up against. It became very exciting. We realized in the early 80s that content needed to drive technology. So I've been on this trek all along. I've been building media systems since the early 80s with computer science and electrical engineering colleagues. I was foolhardy enough to become Associate Dean of Computing of the College of Letters and Science. I built LSIT, which is our computer science, our College of Letters and Science Information Technology Group. I restructured the research of all the departments of the College of Letters and Science, intersected them to the College of Engineering, and then was called on by the Office of the President to launch my vision, which was uniting Silicon Valley with Hollywood, which wasn't being done. Content was not driving technology in the 90s. I started a multi-million-dollar sponsored research program, all out of vision. I didn't know I was doing anything that, you know, I didn't know I was doing anything abnormal. I just thought it was like, okay, I want to do this thing. And I ended up making projects like SETI at Home, which was really the beginning, in a lot of ways, of cloud computing. It was a screensaver that we made in the early 2000s that started distributed processing on PCs. And I got a lot of intellectual property to know how to build what I needed to build in the California Nanosystems Institute. And I was chief scientist of information technology, and that was right when the California Institutes of Science and Innovation project was launched. I delivered the first white paper to build an information technology center on this campus. And I was approached by the Nanites in the early 2000s saying, we want to do a nanosystems institute, and you want to do an information technology center, and shouldn't we do it together? And I said, are you crazy? What is a nanosystems, and what does it have to do with me? And then I realized what they were doing and how they were making new materials for information technology systems. I wanted wearable computing. I wanted all the things that we all want and know are in our reach now. So it was an exciting, forward-looking, bleeding-edge partnership that I think has paid off really wonderfully for all of us. And I see some of my wonderful colleagues in the audience that that have been through all of the slings and arrows of our research in the field. But anyway, again, here I am going off onto tangents, and I don't know where we are.
You're talking about the senses, and you're talking when you've been able to kind of merge sight and sound. Is there any thought of maybe combining other senses
well? We're going for all of them, okay? And it's one of the things I said to one of my biochemist colleagues. You know, I said, okay, I want to map all the senses. All the senses process information as frequency vibration. And he said, not smell and taste, they're chemical. I said, how do you represent them on the computer? And he goes, oh my God, by frequencies. I said, yes. Yes. Because this is where we will go. And eventually, like I said, maybe now we can't feel heat, you know, in a computing, well, you can. I mean, they do generate a lot of heat. But I mean, we can see heat. So we can translate, we can do a translation of a sense into another sense at this point of time. When will we be able to make devices that will allow us computationally to smell and to taste and to feel? Feeling is right around the corner. I mean, like I said, we just hired a haptics professor. I just can't wait for him to get here. Because you know what he's going to make for me, and you know why he's in the Nanosystems Institute using the microfabrication labs? He's going to make skin for me. Skin that I can put on my fingers and I can feel things without having to have devices to feel. Okay, so we're going to go to haptics. We've got visual and aural. We're going to go to haptics. We've got interactivity. We want to feel. Smell and taste will be the next ones that we tackle.
Has use of the allosphere led to new insights into fields other than art?
You know, that's a good question. And no, we haven't made any discoveries yet. And that's because we are not only using these platforms to try to make discoveries, we're building these platforms. So that's what makes it very, very difficult and one of the hardest things to deal with. We didn't build the allosphere as a cave for a particular application and focus on that application and go deep in that application. We're trying to build general purpose computing systems, which means we have to be diverse across application areas, which make it very difficult to make scientific discoveries. However, where we are going right now is deep into materials. It's taken 7 years for us to build the computational infrastructure. We think we have a general purpose platform that's going to allow us now to go forth with our material scientists and tackle what they say will never be able to be tackled. But as artists, we're always going to go for the impossible. It's called the tyranny of scales. So we're trying to now really make a data discovery system that will allow us to make some scientific discoveries. It'll take time. You know, every field, think about how long it takes to make a discovery. This is just 7 years of research. And so we're pretty excited about where we are, but we can't wait. As Chris Anderson said when I did my TED Talk in 2009, and I spoke right after Oliver Sacks, it was a very exciting, very daunting talk. And after it was done, he said, you know, you were great. People loved you. You got a standing ovation, and you can come back when you win the Nobel. So I got a lot on my plate. Don't think I'm going to win the Nobel. But we're going to go forward, and we hope that we will, within the next few years, come up with some real insight.
How have scientists responded to actually hearing their information in 3D sound?
It's very interesting. The hearing thing is the hardest thing for them to hold on to. And it's because most of our scientists, even our very complex scientists, because I keep trying to work with Microsoft Station Q. I mean, these quantum computing mathematicians, you know, they're like, we don't even know how we can think about visualizing our math. I mean, they're so out there, right? So, but we do have some scientists that do understand internal representation of their data. And so visualization is something that they're able to tackle. Sonification right now is really difficult. One of the interesting things that happened with my KITP colleague, Professor Luca Politi, we've been working now for four years probably on the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and we have four different type ways that we've represented that information. And we've gone further. We've gone to the point of where, no, we're not publishing in Nature, but we did publish in Leonardo, which is the Journal of Arts and Science. And in that paper, we were able to prove and really come up with mapping the symmetries of the lower order combinations of the probability wave functions in a very systematic way, and really pushing the advanced quantum mechanic visualization field further along. But what's so interesting about the time-dependent Schrodinger equation in the hydrogen-like atom is it really functions like an audio sound. The Hamiltonians are like standing waves in a pipe organ, and the frequency that you move the probability waveforms are like the fundamental pitch. But when I try to get my physicist to help me figure out how we're going to sonify it, he's really at a loss for figuring out how to do that. So what we did was we took all of the audio information and mapped it into visual data for him so that he could see it and say, yes, the equation is right. See, this is what's so hard about what we're doing right now. What's so difficult is right now we have to make a dialogue, a vocabulary, a language that we can talk to one another with. And they won't. We won't trust one another if they don't believe that the information that we're doing is vetted properly. So we're constantly, it's taking years to have a dialogue. And believe me, a lot of the sacrifice is coming from our side, the artist side.
Are you interested at all in using this technology in like education or anything like that? Because like these simulations are obviously really cool for visualizing that sort of thing, or even like having it replicated around the world for either research or education to make it more accessible.
That's exactly what we're doing. Right now I have a grant from the Mosher Foundation, a gift from the Mosher Foundation, and I have two of my graduate student researchers based at Dos Pueblos High School Engineering Academy. We're bound in
that program.
Well, you're going to probably meet Gustavo and Hannah, who worked last year on the mechatronics project, and I think had a lot to do with the success of that work. We really are bent on educational reform. I do have to tell you, it's really hard for us because we don't have any financial support from the system to do what we do. It costs me $3,000 an hour to run the Allosphere, and I have no permanent support to do that. And so it's hard for me to open the doors and try to bring in as many people as I possibly can. But let's now try to get that out, as you're saying. Let's try to get this out. I'm building different facilities. I'm actually working with MOXIE, the new exploratorium downtown that's being built on State Street, and I'm building a mini Allosphere in the MOXIE, and have been asked to build these at other institutions as well. So the idea is we want to tie this together. We want to do exactly what you're saying. We want to bring this out. This is a new way to teach. I believe that right now, look at what Tsuji Nakamura did with the blue LED, and the fact that LEDs are so cheap that at any point everything will be lit up. It'll be full surround. We need to be prepared for that. We're looking at the educational classroom of the future, where you would go into a room, the whole room would be lit up. You're with the Socratic method. You're talking to your teacher. Each one has your own personal display, your own personal device. You can internalize, you can be an individual, and then you can push it up and you can join the group. You can actually leave the place with your own, and you can be offline or you can be online. As I said, these are worlds within worlds right now that we're looking at. Cyber infrastructure and a cyber infrastructure. I didn't get to show you half of the research that we do in there. So it's interesting where we're going. I mean, iPads, you know, are, you know, windows into worlds. We use them as control devices, etc.
Have you investigated in transforming some of this audible and visual information that we saw into more recognizable shapes, the ones that our students are used to seeing, and perhaps even forming lyrics or songs out of them?
Well, you know, all of the above has been happening. I can't tell you what my students do as media artists, you know. We do a lot of that kind of thing. I mean, a lot of what I do is work very closely with the scientists to get the ground truth principles of how they have internal representation of the information. But even that is hard because some of the representations that I have of the hydrogen-like atom, I can't bring every physicist in there, and every physicist doesn't see the same thing. But if my physicist is there explaining to them how he visualized it, they see it. They can see it. So it's really interesting. I mean, it's been really difficult for me to try to figure out this cultural divide of how you communicate across these disparate fields. But not only that, that the fact that people within the field don't even agree on exactly what's happening. Remember, this information is just so... I mean, one of the things that I was... That really freaks me out about my material scientists is, you know, they're cooking these materials, and then they go in and analyze them on these instruments, and I ask them, well, you know, what are you looking for? We don't know. We don't know. I go, what do you mean you don't know? Well, we think when we cook the material in this way, we think that the way that the grain boundaries are forming has something to do with these metal oxides that are getting in the right place to make sure the material works, but we don't know. You know, and it's just, and for me, that's so exciting because that's exactly where I am every time I compose a piece, right? I don't know what I'm doing, you know? So it's interesting. I mean, to get back to your question about making this and how are we going to communicate and what are we going to do with this? And of course, we'll make beautiful art and music out of any of this. That's our bottom line. That's what we do. We're looking for beautiful worlds to investigate and make new forms of compelling art. And sometimes my students even get mad at me because I'm so rigid about sticking close to the ground truth principles of the science. And they're going, why don't you do this? You know, we just want to create. We don't want to think about all this stuff. I said, you know, guys, you don't have to think about all this stuff. You're just young. You're just starting. I've done 30 years of making out of fantasy. I'm over it, you know? I want the ground truth, cold, hard principle. Where am I with a hydrogen-like atom? That's going to be my first piece. I'm going to make a piece out of it, but it won't be right. It will not be right. But I'm still, it's beautiful. I'm still going to play it. But in truth, you cannot go physically from one probability wave function to another probability wave function like making chords in a piece of music. That's not how quantum mechanics works. But for me to actually make a piece out of that, it's going to take Luca another 2 years to work out the math to do one perturbation on one waveform that's going to explode into a number of waveforms. And, you know, so then I'll make the real piece, but I can still make prototypes. I can still create. I'm an artist, and I'm not going to miss that opportunity, but I really am so tied up with trying to understand the ground truth principles of reality. You know, that's an interesting thing. You know what I found out from my scientist in the California Nanosystems Institute? Reality means different things to different scientists. If you're a subatomic scientist, what happens in the classical world is not real. It's phenomenon. It's a product. It's an output. You talk to a biological scientist, and he'll tell you, or she'll tell you, whatever happens at the subatomic level is not real. So what do I say to my artists? Pick your reality. What reality do you want to work in? You can put your ground truth principles down as art and go from there.
So it would be marvelous to get like all the haptic feedback and the auditory and visual, but given how expensive that would be to get all the mechanisms to interact with all our senses from our body, and I assume you want widespread adoption for education and science, do you think it might be more worthwhile to look into actually connecting directly to the brain using like nanotechnology or such to just feed information directly rather than have these like biosensors and mechanisms?
It could be. The question is, how delicately do we go in that direction? I mean, one of the things that I like to always say to my experimentalists is simulate before you fabricate so that we know what the implications are. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, and I'm one that, you know, embraces whatever the direction is. I mean, evolution, nobody said it was a good thing. It's not good that ancient Greek is dead, but it is, and we need to understand how to survive. So who knows? I think we're going to go through this man-machine kind of thing for a while until we start to figure out exactly how much of the technical aspect we start to actually implant in the body. And we know we're doing that now. I mean, everybody knows about Cheetah Girl, you know, that can run 60 miles an hour. She lost her legs and she had this devices put on her legs and all those pins in her head. And there are interesting things happening. A lot of my colleagues in the Nanosystems Institute, where we are right now, and what's so exciting about where we are, is we're at the interface between biological systems and material systems. And how, I mean, I've got scientists over there working on incredible things, dealing with nanoscale particles that you can put chemotherapy in and try to target the tumor and cure this. My colleague Galen Stuckey, who invented the self-healing gauze for the soldiers in the battlefield and is looking at blood coagulation networks and how to work at these things. These are getting to the points of those kinds of technologies that you're talking about. So who knows? I don't have the answers to those questions, but I'm looking at them, believe me. Okay, guys.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.